Well, how many people have had a materials science or materials engineering class? Just raise your hands if you've had any engineering class about materials, right? Materials, structure, and properties in traditional materials. So,
tutorials.
All right, so not many then. So what I titled this was Lipid Bilayer Membranes and Material Science, Materials Engineering, so that we could start to look at least one material of biology in this kind of context. We've seen lots of stuff on cells and proteins and individual kind of components. But let's take a language, this kind of, developing a vocabulary, so that we can look at things more quantitatively and maybe make more of a connection now to the mathematics or modeling. So, just a bit of background. At Duke, I've been there since 87, and I kind of came up, I was a chemist, or my degrees were in chemistry, and I wondered what these people were who I was, working with, these engineers. And it turned out that they work on hard, dry materials, and so I figured out that I'm kind of different, but what I was different was that I worked on soft, wet materials. And so we'll discuss now more about the differences between soft, wet materials and hard, dry materials, but we'll see that they're treated the same. And if we take this what I call mapping engineering onto biology, then we'll develop a formalism and a framework within which you can then create your models. So it's more like traditional engineering, and engineering might be a dirty word for a lot of people. I don't know. I don't have the kind of experience or interests or whatever. But science, engineering, biology, to me, they're all the same. So I work in my lab with my students. This is a kind of promo picture. My mother likes it, so I always put it up, And
you look like Bill Clinton.
Bill Clinton. It's funny because people.
You get a lot of women applying to your lab.
Well, actually, yeah, but. It tends to be African Americans think I look like Bill Clinton, and then some of the other people have had that Australian guy, the crocodile guy, Crocodile Dundee, and then I like the Robert Redford one best. That's just me.
You should have had this picture up on the website for this program.
I sent it last week.
Oh, that was too late though.
Alright, so I invented this cancer treatment, which is now in clinical trials, and it started with understanding the bilayer. And so we'll talk about that a little bit in 2 weeks or a week on Monday. So I'll kind of develop an engineering view, a bio-inspired view of how to create this kind of thing. It's a little bit hindsight, but because it's a 30, 40 year story. And I got involved in it, the last 20 years. But it's a liposome with a membrane. They look like this under cryo-EM. They're 100 nanometers across. They're faceted, look like soccer balls. And then they release the drug in the bloodstream and all the tumors disappear. Oh, I got somebody trying to better turn off my Skype. all my students are on Skype now, so you got Skype as well, do you? Skype here.
We don't use it here.
Yeah, well, I thought you did because one of your technicians said it. I have to get rid of this guy. Let me just go out of this. I think it's gone. So, and actually, Alex Wright, who was trying to contact me, he's done a lot of the work on these liposomes.
Well, you should mention his name.
So that's that. But then, here's a nice little video. What I'm starting to do now with these micropipettes, this is a crystal on the end of a pipette, and this is actually a sodium chloride crystal, a single crystal. And so now we're down at this micron scale, 20 microns. And this is a little video of a water droplet dissolving, but if you put salt solution in it, it doesn't go all the way. It's dissolving in another organic liquid, so water does dissolve in oil. this is a long chain alcohol, but when it gets to this point, 11 molar sodium chloride, this happened. That's crystallization of sodium chloride at a micro scale. So, you know, there's maybe a lot of modeling there too. But now we're looking at mass moving into a droplet and all the rest of it. But so this was the beginnings of trying to think about biomineralization. Of course, Dan Morse at UCSB out here. And my first attempts to kind of figure something like this out was to make crystals like this. Now, these crystals are an inorganic, organic composite. Of course, these crystals are calcium carbonate with protein between them. These are actually bilayer crystals made from detergent and calcium. It's that, you know, when you have non-ionic detergents, when you have ionic detergents and you used to take a bath and there's all this scum around the bathtub, you know, that my mother used to tell me that was dirt. It wasn't my dirt, you know, like I wasn't that dirty. It was the hard water and the calcium, you know. And but now we've got these non-ionics. But this is a nice combination. When you do it in the right way, in the right ratios and everything, you get these nice crystals. Which are, you know, they've got an optical axis, they're only a few nanometers thick, they're maybe, we don't know, maybe 10 or 15 bilayers thick, and they form these flat crystals. So it's a new mineral that I haven't published it yet, but I'm going to call it basconite. It's a new material. Anyway, so, but when you put them in a bottle, for the fluid mechanics people, when you put them in a bottle, put a light underneath it, this is how they kind of flow, and because they're so flat, they just follow the streamlines. And they've got this very ethereal kind of calming, stress-relieving thing. So this is my next invention. It's a new lava lamp, kind of, but it's for stressed individuals, you know. So that's my next thing. Anyway, so that's a little bit of background. So where I started in this was, you know, I had to teach a class to make a contribution to the school. Of course, you know, I had no engineering. The only class I ever had in engineering was the one I taught, and it was this material science and engineering class. So I learned it from a book, and I got Scientific American, and I found, you know, lots of things to make the class interesting. But I'd done absolutely no composition, structure, property, processing, and performance of metals, ceramics, polymers, plastics, semiconductors, and composites. I was a day ahead of the student for 42 lectures, you know, it was kind of a sham. And so I've rebelled against this recently because I've, you know, got the power to do that now. And and I created this new course, this new kind of curriculum, mapping engineering onto biology. But you have to know what engineering is first in order to do that. So that's what I'll start with. We'll tell you about that on a week on Monday. But at the moment, let's just look at a simple materials matrix and see if we could use it in looking at biology in this materials way. So all materials used in products and processes engineered for society are made from just these four classes, you know, or their combinations. So metals, ceramics, plastics, semiconductors, and composites. So what's the first question you're going to ask? What are the equivalent materials that make up biology? So we've seen cells, membranes, eyes, nose, teeth, you know, muscles, all sorts of things. So what are we going to put in this list for biology? Because we'll still want to know the composition, structure, property, processing, performance relationships. So characterize relationships then between materials composition, atomic, chemically distinct entities. Of course, there's some structure when you draw these things out, but structure, the atomic defects, crystals, amorphous microstructures, properties now. This is the ratio of what you do to how it responds. By stress over strain, given the modulus of elasticity, shine light on it, light absorbed, light reflected, put a voltage on it, you know, there's current, it doesn't go very far, it's resisted, whatever it is. You know, so the language now we want to kind of create is that composition and structure properties are actually properties of materials. It's not the performance of the material. Performance is another thing. It's still quantified. But, you know, the property of this cell isn't that it crawls. That's a performance. The property of this cell is it has a viscosity of 1,000 points. So processing then for shaping material into a product, molding in plastics, drawing, rolling metals, and the reason this kind of comes in under, you know, like as one of the relationships is in order to process metals, if you want to get a wire or a sheet from an ingot of metal, then you just roll it, right? Well, you can't can't just roll it, you roll it and anneal it, roll it and anneal, because during the rolling process you create defects. Those defects make the material brittle, and that brittleness would crack your process. So properties are changed during processing, maybe because of a change of structure, but not a change of composition. So metal is still the metal, it's not oxidized, it's not anything, it's just got a new structure which changes its property. So those are the kind of things that, you know, I want to try and bring out a week on Monday, and I'll pose it in another way. How did nature solve certain problems with these materials under these design methodology kind of framework? But for now, let's just look at it in terms of materials. So biology is also a series to me now of products and processes. Therefore, the exploration we had a few years ago was, can I actually map this onto biology, and what would we get? And over 150 students now have been through this program. I had 11 students in 2003, 37, some undergraduates found it, 52 and 92 this semester. So some of my work while I'm still here is video conferencing back, and I've got this video conference unit on my desk now to go, and I'll go back for 2 weeks to do the presentations, but we'll tell you more about that on Monday. So if you do anything from this little session here, and Duke students are great at memorizing things, and this is the first homework I give, please memorize this. So if you want to memorize that, that would be good. So how might we define biology then? Can we define biology by its materials? Just a simple question. So what I would now do is just draw exactly the same thing, and as we've seen, and it's in Lodish, and it's in Albert's, lipids, sugars, amino acids, nucleotides, salts, and water. Anybody asks you what biology is, you just list those materials. Now, it's a lot more than that, obviously, but that's the materials view of it, and they obviously build into molecular composites at a very, very early stage. A lipid with a sugar on it is already a molecular composite. Lipids that associate together to form bilayers, sugars that associate now and polymerize to form carbohydrates, amino acids that form proteins, nucleotides that form DNA, RNA, salts and water that are actually part of the structures that are created. So when I've said, don't forget the water, and have I mentioned that too, these materials don't exist without the water. And water is part of the structure. If you look at it energetically, the layer to remove the last layer of water requires a lot of energy. It's almost at the same level as it is a chemical energy. So that's what I wanted to kind of mention. So the molecular composites at an early stage, associated structures, obviously, the membranes, the cells, the organelles, higher order systems, organs, tissues, and organisms. So now we're starting to look at nano to micro scales to macro consequences and macro scales. So this is the bigger view of what we're all involved in. And again, property is, to me now, if you look at that molecular biology of the cell, it's got all the composition down here, it's got all the structures of biology, it's got all the processing and performance, there's not a property in the book. And so the challenge now is to bring property into biology. Just, if that's only the first thing we do, we'll start to now really understand mechanism of how does this receptor release this binding site down here. What is the property that allows this molecule to perform its function? It's an alpha helices stiffness. And it's this receptor binding up here that causes the scissor movement. And these are real materials. They've actually got actions. So if you want to get away from the biology language of protein structure function, you now talk about what is the property of this material that allows it to perform its action. And you're talking now about a handicapped door. You just push on the thing there, the door opens, there's some hydraulics going on, there's some electronics going on. Same thing's a channel. Let's think of a channel as a handicapped door. There's a signal on the outside, there's an action, and you walk through. So, this is the kind of engineering view. I'm very simple, very simplistic in how I see things. I don't know all the details, but if you can kind of present a big picture, then and get, very intelligent people that are very focused on knowing methodology now to come in and fill in this property thing, and the hierarchical systems, the statistics of the whole thing. Some things are not certain, some things are uncertain, that whole thing. So inherent in biology is products and processes, then is design, and that's what I'll talk about in workshop one. I was up at 5 o'clock this morning so that I could talk to the people on the East Coast in a committee, National Academy of Sciences. They've asked me to be involved with some other people in a biomolecular materials new report that's going to come out at the end of this year, and it's going to influence people like DOE, NIH, NSF, and there's been several reports on this through the years, but this was a slide that was presented this morning, and it's Sam Stupp's slide, and it's obviously been going around a little bit, but somebody from NSF or DOE presented, and I thought it was something I'd just bring up this morning. I don't think it's that confidential, but this is Sam's view of material science and biology. And it was that materials that imitate biology, materials to monitor biology, materials to learn from or to biology, and then this was materials to repair biology, and then use biology to make materials. So, you know, that then becomes a really kind of global view of what you might end up with if you can place your knowledge of biology, knowledge of engineering, knowledge of science and chemistry, physics, and mathematics in this context to achieve these kind of tasks. So we set up this Center for Biologically Inspired Materials and Material Systems, and at the moment we have an IGER from NSF, and I would say that we have at least three tenants. The overriding thing was to see if we can and to what extent map engineering to biology. So reverse engineer nature's designs for molecules, membranes, and cells, and I'll talk about what reverse engineering is next week. What were the problems nature solved, and how did nature solve the X problem? So if you now look at anything that we saw in the last few days from Hannah or the other lady who talked about, you know, biology, just it's a channel. What was the problem nature solved with, say, the kidneys, the glomerulus, the kidney cell, and the aquaporin channel? And the question actually starts to turn a little bit when you do this, because now you ask the question, what was the problem this molecule solved in the context of evolution? Hemoglobin was in the biosphere before oxygen was in the atmosphere. All the phylogenetic trees red, except for some copper in octopus and some mollusks. And so there's a secondment of materials through that evolutionary process that we'd like to also get some handle on. And the key thing has been, that's what this cartoon's about, is to develop and use techniques to quantify composition, structure, and properties at the nano and micro scales. Of course, the atomic force microscope, the laser tweezers, microscale, I'm going to show you our micropipettes for looking at cells and membranes. And then forward engineer new products and processes inspired by nature's solutions. You can't do this until you've done these. You can't until you reverse engineer all the design. Now, you know, you can jump in at any point and invent anything. But in order to truly do this as a community, I think everybody, it's incumbent on everybody to start to do this process, reverse engineer nature designs using techniques, mathematical as well as physical, experimental, theoretical, and then forward engineer new products when you have more information. You don't know where the invention is going to come from. You're sat on the toilet after you've done this and you go, wow, that's... You know, you've had an idea, you're taking a shower, you're having a cup of coffee. You don't know when it's going to happen, but you need to feed it. This is an invention generator. So it's all about water. We've seen a little bit of that and oil. So cell membranes, lipid membranes, and material. Talk a little bit about composition, structure, and properties mainly. This is what I want to talk about mostly. Mechanical, electrical, thermal, permeability, molecular exchange, inter-surface interactions, some surface-molecule interactions. One slide or two on lipid material processing, and then one slide on this anti-cancer treatment. So there's probably, you know, I'm going to go through a lot of this stuff without even talking about it. We've seen a little bit of composition, but I wanted to put it up on the web so you had a chance to go back to it and review it then. So with only an hour, you know, we'll just go through it. So it's the in vivo drug delivery. So something fundamental, and oil and water don't mix. Everybody knows that. So here's oil. Here's water, and yes, they do, if you've ever had mayonnaise, or got milk. So let's make some milk, and I do this for some students. One of the questions we had, one group was interested in breast cancer. I said, if you're interested in breast cancer, let's look at what the breast actually does, makes milk, right? So one of the things. So the question then was, it requires, if we were going to make milk or make an emulsion, so So this is this is what you see, the white liquid. At 1,000 times magnification, you'll see fat droplets under the optical microscope, and if you went down even further, you'd see fat globules plus casein micelles. Of course, the surfactants need to be on these monolayers here. And if we try and do this, we've got to do some violent homogenization to get this emulsion. How did nature do it? So I asked the students, how does nature create a highly homogenized suspension without shaking the car? There's no shaking going on in the car there. So how does that happen? So they'll answer that this semester. But the point I wanted to make with this, there's a couple of them. One was the same physical and chemical compositions, structures, forces, properties, and performance of these materials are present in every cell of every organism on the planet. So your physics and chemistry is already here in a glass of milk. But the processing is different for this, how it arrived. So all the things we're talking about, the softness of the materials, the role of water, the structures, the mixing and matching of, like I said, aqueous and non-aqueous systems are all in that glass of milk. Now, there's a lot more to biology than that, but the physics and chemistry and the modeling are still at that level. So if we just look at, as an example, and I'll kind of divide the talk into performance, composition, structure, processing, and so this is about performance, just to motivate it. So here's one of those cartoons of a cell again, some multi-component membrane, lipid bilayer structure. The question you want to ask, though, is what are the properties of this material for pure lipid and lipid mixtures? And I'll talk about cell membranes next time and use the red blood cell, a quintessential kind of mechanical device for getting oxygen around the body. But understanding the cell membrane then is the motivation. But what about the lipid bilayer just as an interesting material? I mean, good God, it's two molecules thick and it surrounds every cell on the planet. So, we're talking about nanomaterials that have been around for 10 to 9 years. Some lipid membrane bound capsules then. So here's one. That's what you see. Anybody tell me a property that you can derive from that image? What property can you get of this material just by looking at it? Anyway.
Surface tension?
Some tension in the surface, maybe. We had this thing yesterday. I mean, that was a great way of looking at cells and how they kind of organize. But interfacial tensions in surface chemistry mean something different to tensions in the surface in cells and cell membranes. But yeah, I mean, Sandra, you could probably.
Okay, sickle cell anemia would have a
different shape. We would eventually, yeah. But from here, it's the undulations. And the forcing function here is flapping around in the thermal breeze. And so we know what KT is. Therefore, if we take some kind of image, some intensity profile of this over time, we'll get, flickers in the flicker spectroscopy. I mean, that's the kind of idea. So there's a bending stiffness that you can get out of this. And that's been done. Here's a white blood cell. Now, that's Brownian motion. There's very little motion of the membrane because this is, when we suck it into a pipette, it has 1,000 points of viscosity. It's 70% water. All the water is kind of obviously taken up in hydrated states, but this structure has got, protein filaments through it, granules through it, and we'll see a picture in a minute, but that's all it does on the bottom of the microscope slide is show you that, again, water molecules are banging into it, moving around. It's not activating, it's not going anywhere, it's not receiving a signal, it's relatively passive.
What's the size?
10 microns across, 7 microns across. So the red cell is 7 microns, this is again 8 microns, and this is a 20 micron vesicle. And this is just pure lipid. This is the material that surrounds every cell on the planet, this one and that one. And I think I just pulled it up as, a bigger picture. So the bending stiffness comes right after that. That's modeling, Sackman, Evans, a bunch of people of Lipowski, all these guys. So
how do they, out of curiosity, if you're looking at the fluctuations of this membrane, the pixel size is just too big.
Well, in my microscope, maybe. Yeah. And it goes, we'll see in a minute, it goes with tension, it goes with composition,
I would say the resolution doesn't seem sufficient that it'll pull out that
Maybe on my microscope.
Uh-huh.
If you go to oil immersion lens, we see some really incredible resolution there. So, what are the composition, structure, property relationships that allow them to perform their functions then as cells next week? Micron machines, things that crawl around, they've got motility, they've got pharma, they're anti-warfare for warfare for bacteria. And then this little thing, what can we do with lipids? And liposomes are one of the products. So this is a nice picture from Ping Beal of somebody that's very passive white blood cell now. And now you see some fine structure from SEM of these microvilli, which have got protein filaments in them. There's a muscle membrane underneath, the membrane, and then there's the red cell. So they're two very different cells that flow through the bloodstream. The neutrophil has excess area. If this is going to turn into a sausage shape, and we'll see that in a minute, then the way in which it does that is not to deform as a sphere and put stress on the membrane, but just unfold the membrane. And the red cell circulates for 120 days. It's now got a smooth structure. Spectrin network takes up the shear because the liquid membrane has none of that. And it's capable of being deformed many times, going through liver sinusoids. And here was a little movie of red cells going through small capillaries. And here's the white cell coming through, squeezing down, but bouncing back into a sphere, and then going through another capillary, and that's how it gets through. So we can talk more about that next time. So if I just start now with some of the performances, i.e. before we get into the actual properties, these are things that the membrane has to do. It's a mechanical, chemical, electrical barrier. We heard that definition. In order for it to be a mechanical, chemical, electrical barrier, it has to have the flexibility and strength in order to perform its capsular function when it's doing a lot of different things. Just sitting there is one thing, but it coats this thing. Here's a blown, an osmotically lysed neutrophil. We captured it on the SEM, and these are all the granules inside it. If you actually dissolve off that lipid bilayer, that's the muscle protein underneath the membrane. So it has to coat every one of these fine microvilli. If we suck it into a capillary 5 microns diameter, if anybody wants to look up at a blue sky before the clouds come in, you'll see these little white dots in the back of your eye. That's called the blue entopic phenomena, and they're white blood cells going through capillaries in your retina. And so we do that experiment. We suck it into a pipette. Of course, it's going to go into the tissue. Well, that's a 30 or 40% change in area. And that's not going to happen if you've got, you have to stretch it as a material, but if you just unfold it, it's got all the excess area. It's probably got 100% excess area totally. Because one of the things it does in the body is to eat yeast particles. And Evan Evans' postdoc there, a technician, spent all morning feeding one of these cells about 12 yeast particles. And it took up most of the area to do that, and then it got full, and it wouldn't eat anymore. But it did stop, but it still adhered. So there's still receptors for recognition, adhesion. It would engulf if you hadn't filled it to capacity. And so the membrane stays intact while it does that. These are cancer cells on a plated out on a dish. And we've seen these kind of pictures before. But look at the fine promontories that go out here. These membranes have got to bend now at a level of only a fraction of a micron. So now we're taking a telephone book and bending it. How far can you do that? And what is that relationship? So this is where the bending stiffness comes in. And then, of course, they round up. So in all these processes, we're looking for this material to stay in here. And here's that we'll just show it again. This was the thing we saw the other day, but I want to make a different point, as we're watching this. This membrane is staying intact as all the processes that are going on inside the cell are pushing that membrane around. It's not getting left behind on the glass cover slip. It's not, leaking. If it leaked, then this thing would lose all its guts. So the membrane stays intact as the cell hears, crawls over the surface, chasing the bacteria, eventually engulfs it, and then there's the website for David Rogers. I think it's somebody else's website up at Harvard.
You mean that the membrane lipid is staying intact?
Yeah, the membrane.
Maybe it's some extracellular protein.
Right.
They're making sort of footprint.
Just take a plastic bag and just roll it around, you know, put your hand inside, that membrane doesn't break. But I'm just saying there's a requirement there that you might not think of in intuitively, but this membrane stays intact. Now this is an experiment where we blow the same scent of that bacterium at a neutrophil while we hold it. This is Don Giorgile's experiment. And so out of this pipette is coming the smell of a bacterium, and rather than letting the cell crawl around, the cell sends out this pseudopod and grows the pseudopod in the direction of the chemical gradient. And so Doncho, these are one of the first experiments he's done. He's now looking at signal transduction pathways when this happens using various markers of, you know, fluorescence for the AKT, all the receptors all the way down to, say, AKT and beyond. And so, you know, what we're seeing here is a very flat, rigid, this cell has got a viscosity of 1,000 poise, this is a very elastic material. So there's a transition here from viscous material to an elastic material. Very stiff, there are no granules in here, they're all excluded. This is the polymer, this is the actin network that is now being formed in order for it to either crawl around if it had a surface or engulf the particle, you know, if it made contact.
What is that thing?
That's a little bacterium that was in the solution.
Is it a bacteria or is
it a
membrane? You know, because
no, it's a bacteria. They're just, you know, you have solutions and they're in the lab and on the bench, you know. So there's bacteria.
But the cells would do that.
Yeah,
they just pinch out the membrane and you can have a lot of
vesicles. That's too complicated. It came out of this right-hand pipette. So what happens, though, is you can continue blowing this, and it goes through a cycle. It now starts to retract. Even under a stimulus, this is now starting to retract. If you blew at the top while it was doing this, it wouldn't send out a pseudopod. If you blow here and here simultaneously, it sends out two. So there's all this signaling going on inside the cell now in response to what happens at that membrane, just like
by blowing, you mean inflating and deflating?
No, just blowing with this pipette. This pipette
literally blowing.
We're blowing from this
literally.
Pipette, yeah, we're blowing a solution that contains a chemotactic agent, either FMLP, I think it is, or 4-mol ester. It's whatever this cell responds to when that bacterium in the previous slide was giving off that smell at homeopathic concentrations. So anyway, there's some modeling for people to go look at. Now you've got all those signal transduction pathways, you've got active polymerization, of course, you know, people in biomedical, bioengineering, physical chemistry are looking at that.
Let me
so
ask a question. I mean, I'm trying to picture what's happening.
Yeah.
And to what extent is this purely the membrane, and to what extent is it the things inside?
It's the things inside, but the membrane copes it. So the point is that inside is an actin network, which is being created with actin binding proteins, actin releasing proteins. The whole thing is now stimulated with this, and this is happening in real time. So, you know, we saw those signal transduction pathways up on the board, and you can get them on any magazine now, any of these companies that sell all their reagents. But it's a very static kind of picture. I mean, what I like about this is the dynamics of that.
To some extent, it's limited by the diffusion of actin itself from
the actin is being polymerized. G actin is in the cell and is being polymerized in that direction. So there's a new material being made in response to a environmental signal.
So if you put the cell into a dish, that it actually relaxed to the original shape?
Yeah, and so this idea that there's actually a tension in the membrane, there is. You can represent it as a cortical tension, just like you would a liquid drop.
Mm-hmm.
But phenomenologically, it's not a surface tension, it's a tension in the surface. The surface tension now being, you know, the thermodynamic equilibrium associated with these interfaces. So there is a very small tension, it's 0.3 millinewtons per meter, so that's a tiny tension, but 1,000 poise viscosity is what it acts on. We've got experiments where we suck it into the pipette, blow it back out again, let it recover. And so that's just really a very simple mechanical tension working on the dashpot.
But if that is a bacteria, why is the pseudopod going into it?
I wouldn't worry about that bacteria. It just came out of the pipette. I mean, you know, I'm sorry. I would just
when you have contamination, then it's very nice. If you had to throw it away,
I
things, the concentration difference, and also he said that they said the ligand being blown away from the pipette, so bacterial chemical will not diffuse in. Probably.
Let's switch to decaf.
But I think that is not a bacteria, that's just membrane changing.
It's a bacterium from this pipette. It's okay. It's okay.
It's contamination.
It's contamination. You're right.
David, is it reversible?
What I said was that once you see this thing. Over time, you would plot the length of that projection versus time, and it goes up and then it comes down, even though the stimulus is still there. So this might be on the order of, you know, micromolar, or 10⁻⁷, 10⁻⁸ molar formal peptide.
What do you believe the limiting factor is? Why is it soft? Is it the amount of active present in the cell, or is it the fact that the membrane can't stretch anymore?
It can stretch. There's a lot more area. And there's still a lot more actin.
So what do you think?
The cell just goes, this is too much trouble, or you know, it's, I don't know what the process is now, but it's turning off its response.
Well, there's adaptation of the receptors in the cell surface.
Yeah, and that's what Doncho is now looking at, is the receptor recycling. Like I said, his work now has moved on to a lot more of this signaling. I know this is interesting for all sorts of reasons. The point I wanted to make was that this membrane stays intact around this projection, so the cell doesn't leak all its contents.
So if you have receptors in that membrane, presumably they're becoming less dense as it stretches out in that way. I mean, they're getting spread over a larger area.
They may do. They're being recycled. Now, to what extent they can be cycled back through a very flat, rigid interior is another thing. So there's a lot of dynamics going on here at the molecular scales.
There can also be diffusion of the receptors within the membrane.
Yeah, they can diffuse this way once they've bound the formal peptide. But the initial signal is the thing that kicks it off, and then the receptors may or may not be involved anymore. So, all right, well, this looked like it was a success, except for this little bacterium. And if that stimulates you to think more about cells, cell processing, then that's good. The point, like I said, all I wanted to make was that the membrane stays intact. So, what are membranes made out of? Well, turns out that we've got all these choices. Of course, a lot of them are useless. But it's just going to be hydrogen, carbon, oxygen, phosphorus, nitrogen. And so, let me just go through about 5 or 6, 10 slides here on composition leading in, because we've had that with Hammer, but we'll leave it up on the web. So CH2 units form things like octane, hydrocarbons store lots of energy, only a few of these are used nearly pure hydrocarbons like wax candles in our thing, in my car, so you wax the car, you know. Fatty acids, so now you put a little group on the end of this thing. And it's now got this surface active property. Saturated, unsaturated, typical fats, you know, all things the same. CH, some of the things we saw were CH, you know, two bonds, double bonds, and of course in your breakfast you'll see a lot of this stuff. Saturated, unsaturated. Then glycerol, this small molecule. Well, if you stick one of these hydrocarbon chains, you get the glycerides. If you put three on, you can get triglycerides. And these are very fatty now, depending on what that hydrocarbon chain is in relation to the ambient temperature. So we can turn this material into a wax at room temperature by having a long chain. We can keep it oily by having a short chain. And these are some of the fatty acids in animals, different things. Again, I don't need to read too much into this at the moment. So phospholipids are the next thing, and of course we've seen that, and that's how that built up. Different representations we saw, the Hammer again out of molecular biology of the cell, and this idea that there are four different lipids in the red cell membrane, or cell membranes in general, and they are also asymmetric on the inside and outside of the cell, how that's maintained, and then this molecule cholesterol. So these are the compositions, but of course you start to see structure immediately. And so the interesting thing about this cholesterol is that it's got a flat ring structure. This has the capacity to go all trans and form, you know, a nice flat at least region for van der Waals interaction here. There might be some head group thing. There's a little bit of a gap here. So now you're structuring molecules next to each other, and depending on their relative concentrations, they will influence the structure and also the properties. So biological and soft-white materials, the thing I might just focus on first is water. So I had this discussion with Evan a few years ago. We were just sat in a restaurant and water came up and into discussion. And I said, what do you think the most important thing that water does? And he had his view and I had my view, and like, we agreed to agree that water is an organizing solvent. We've seen this now. Its hydrophilic, hydrophobic effects help create molecular structure in all these materials we've been talking about. It limits mass of solutes in solution by solubility. Evan's view of this was it influences energy of interactions. So in the electrodynamic, electrostatic intermolecular interactions, it discounts any energy compared to vacuum by a constant of 80, the dielectric constant. And that's in the you know, denominator of any of these energy interaction equations. We might also say life began in the oceans, and so there's a permanent stamp on the chemistry of living things. And life hinges on the properties of water because it's part of the composition. So we don't leave water out when we're dealing with any of these molecules. It helps determine its structure. As for your, for the, you know, the mathematicians, computer scientists, maybe just here's some water. If you want to just go over this yourself later. Some of the things that water does in terms of, you know, acid-base equilibria, hydrogen bonding, we've seen that. Salts and water, they all kind of interact now. And of course, these are very important interactions now. As we've said, those protein side chains have got charges, and water has got to interact with them in a dipolar way, ion dipolar, dipole, dipole interactions. So they're all part now of interactions. You know, what we've seen up to now, I think, have been a lot of the you know, just the pictures. We need to add some numbers to this. Acetone in water, and then 2-methylpropane. So this is what we had before, was this cage-like structures or organization, the entropy effect, and then here satisfying hydrogen bonds, and so it's soluble. So those are two things. Now, so lipids then, when you put them in water, otherwise they're a dry white powder. When you put them in water, you get these spontaneously form either micelles, and this is a kind of shape idea, bricks versus you know, these kind of triangular structures for molecules, and we've got a whole series of phases that these might take up. That might be like regular detergents, and then that's the possibilities. So the bilayer 2D fluid, I think we saw this as well, but the point here is that there are several types of motions. It can rotate this way, it can flex, it's got lateral diffusion, and then sometimes it flips from one side to the other, and those things can all be nucleated. The double bond makes things liquid-like at room temperature or body temperature, and if you take all the double bonds out, you get fats, the stuff that we're not supposed to eat anymore. So here's, say, you know, fluid mosaic model. Lots of people are Clark Shilton, Rasmol image, we heard about that. But so this is multi, you know, water molecules, lipid molecules. This is what the bilayer might look like. Now I've got two friends at Duke, Tom McIntosh, Sid Simon. Sid is now involved in taste and smell, and Tom continues to do X-ray diffraction. He's probably one of the best people in the world. Adrian Parsegian, Peter Rand, Tom McIntosh, and Sid have done a lot of work now on these bilayers. And what they produce for us, this is actually for the German people in the audience, this is 128 phospholipids, 3,000 VASA molecules, and the box is 6 by 6 by 7 nanometers. But this is what Tom produces, is an electron density profile of a bilayer. And so this is where the head group is, where the electron-rich regions are. This is the bilayer center, where it's electron-poor, and then electron-rich, and then the water again. So what he gets out of this is a really a neat measurement now of bilayer thickness, as well as total, you know, bilayer dimensions, as well as the water gap. And then then some structure inside. So,
literally between two halves of the tails, there's almost no electrons.
Right, there the density goes down.
Yeah, so it's like.
But it's not a vacuum, though. But the nature of holding vacuum.
Yeah, like
there's just not as much density associated with that region. You're dipping in and out, and but you know the bilayer is narrow. It's actually the van der Waals attraction to water on either sides of the bilayer that help to keep the bilayer together.
Yeah.
Now there's some intrinsic van der Waals as well, you know, in that region, but there's also a force which is acting across here, you know, potential energy across it. So now we had a. Workshop a while ago in our center, and I just pulled this up. I just put it out this morning I just looked him up on the web. And he's called Jürgen Plitzko, and he's at the Max Planck, I think. Has anybody heard of Jürgen? Okay, yeah. So these are some traditional images of cells and membranes and nuclear pores and that. Well, this is the image that he gets from cryo-EM. So there's a lot of processing going on, but this is a pore now. One of those nuclear pores, and I think these people are starting to really reveal some of the structures and some of the dynamics involved in living cells or cells that have been created to do this cryo-EM. And that's probably the next one of the next techniques for structure. That's the nuclear pore. I copied some things off, but just one version of it. But I don't know anything about this except I thought this audience might like to see that cryo-EM is a cryo-electron tomography is a really neat technique. So look at the dimensions, 125 nanometers, 60 nanometers, 40 nanometers.
What kind of dynamics? The nuclear pore does not expand.
Yeah, I'm just saying this technique allows you to do dynamic measurements within cells as they're performing whatever they're performing. We can read this up. I've got some properties. All right, so let's now focus on properties in the last 15, 20 minutes. So membrane deformation and expansion failure, partitioning maybe associated with that, electroporation, thermal transitions. Is our continuum mechanics guy here? So he's over there. So we talked earlier, and what Evan did was recognize that you could take all these stresses on the cube and collapse them down into a thin sheet. And so the normal and in-plane stresses become isotropic dilation, becomes shear, and becomes cutting and bending stresses. And so these are the three ways in which any deformation can now be represented for any membrane. And this is Evan, and he worked with Dick Scalak to create this book, Thermodynamics of Biomembranes, Mechanics of Thermodynamics, in 1980. Dick died a few years ago, Evan's still cooking, and these are the kind of things then that he left us with from the early 80s that he's developed and brought into membrane mechanics and now molecular mechanics. So if we look at our diagram, and I'll talk about this on Monday, define the function, it might be a component karyotype, like a red cell, select the materials, component design, analysis of materials performance. This is kind of what we're involved in when we're doing these kind of measurements. Of course, we've got to define the specs, choose production methods, prototypes, establish production, further development, if we're going to look at this in a true context of design. But anyway, what he's got out of this then is an expression for the area dilation modulus, the bending that we saw, as a function of curvature, and then surface shear agility characterized by shear stresses. This is zero for a lipid bilayer, so liquid. You stir your coffee, there's no elasticity in the coffee, right? You put your finger in, the hole disappears. But unless there's a viscous component. But just pure shear elasticity doesn't exist in these liquid membranes, but it does in the red cell because of that spectrum network. So for liquid membranes, it's zero. Viscose coefficients characterize liquid behavior for dilation and bending deformation. They're on the order of molecular time scales, 10 to minus 5, 10 to minus 10 seconds. The liquid membrane itself does have a viscosity of set 2 Poiseuille. So here's our technique. It's a micropipette station. These micromanipulators bring a tiny pipette in, and what we're going to see is the tip of that pipette in the microscope chamber. that we can now manipulate individual cells, record it on tape, and do some analysis.
Since you're bringing up viscoelasticity, elasticity, it might be worth in a mathematical argument saying that there is no general theory of viscoelasticity or viscoelasticity, if you prefer.
Mm-hmm.
We have mathematics to describe ideal fluids, which is the Davis-Stokes equation, and we have the equations for continuum elastic. Elastic mechanics for the classical elasticity, but for materials that both deform and flow at the same time,
mm-hmm.
there is no general set of equations that interpolate between the Navier-Stokes equations and the equations of continuum mechanics. That's a huge unsolved mathematical problem.
Yeah, do you have a comment on that, or especially in relation to some membranes or biology?
Well, but there are a lot of models. I mean,
yeah.
You have the Albright B and Bingham
yeah.
plastics, there are
uh-huh.
hundreds essentially.
But they have limited
But those are purely phenomenological models. There's no fundamental set of equations.
But they're the stress strain. You know, in Navier-Stokes phases it is, and then you just put in the stress strain or stress shear. But you can make it, I'm saying you can do experiments, see which category it fits into and use that. And people go from those models down to the molecular scale. So I wouldn't say it's an unsolved, I'd say it's an embarrassment of riches. There's almost too many models, and the key is to try to find out the holding material A, which rheological model best approximates.
Well, Max Planck said the experiment is the only source of knowledge at our disposal.
I mean, it depends on the material.
Because it's a material property.
Right, yeah.
But there are many models that have to go from the molecular scale picture and choose one of these models. You can go from the continuum to these deep spring models, and they may be phenomenological, but you can fit the constants in that.
Well, just on the level of nonlinear phenomena.
Like it's the same. You use a Casson equation to try and figure out the stress strain, and then you put it in.
Can I just finish and we can maybe talk later? But this is experimental. Whatever
well, yes,
your
model is.
Yeah.
Just briefly, I would say, on the level of nonlinear phenomena, you can write down the equations that determine viscoelasticity elasticity in general. But it turns out there are far too many open parameters that, in principle, are involved, so that this is even richer than the plethora of models that you mentioned. But you can also find out that a bunch of these models are fundamentally inconsistent. They just throw away the entropy and stuff like this. So.
The ones that engineers use, it's like the most plastics or gels or things like that, you can pretty much come close.
Or you can fit the data by the second volume.
Well, I know which one, because most of them don't.
So here's the experiment. Here's the experiment. So now we're just applying a tiny suction pressure to the pipette to bend the membrane into the pipette. And this is a millionth of an atmosphere of suction pressure, which over a, say, an 8-micron pipette is somewhere in the peak of Newton range of force to bend the membrane. So that's the limit of our resolution, though. It takes about 2 dynes per square centimeter, and Evan's analysis was just, again, this suction pressure raises the pipette Q to an 8, gives 16 times 10 minus 12, turned out to be an overestimate. More sensitive measurements that I'll just mention in a minute put us down around 1 to 5 times 10 minus 12. So we're in just a few KT, and that's where we're at now in terms of bending.
Sorry, what's KC?
KT. KC here is 16 times 10
minus
12.
No, but what is it?
What the bending moment.
Oh, the moment, yeah.
Yeah, it's.
Oh,
okay. How would you know? You know, reading the slides. So this is the expansion experiment. This is a single bilayer just like that, but it's got sugar in the sugar solution and salt outside to balance any osmotic pressures, so any suction pressure doesn't change the volume. And so now we're just aspirating this, and you can hear it creaking as it breaks. So that's the experiment that I carried out, and here's the analysis then, just a simple stress. Strain is area change, you get it from the pipette, radius or diameters there, and then the length change gives you a measure of area change because you measure a linear dimension. But the thing we get out of that now is this membrane tension in the membrane versus area change. And we end up now, for something that's only two molecules thick, we get the tensile strength, the critical strain, strain energy, and then its elasticity. So tension versus area strain gives these properties of this material now.
So and when you say only two molecules, it's a whole lipid bilayer.
It's only two molecules thick.
But they're all, I'm confused. It's a polar heads and all the carbon chains, so
it's
you mean the whole unit, but it's many.
Well,
many
it's two molecules thick.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's, I'm saying, that makes it sound very small, in fact.
It is very small.
Thick. Wow.
It's 4 nanometers.
Right.
It's two molecules thick.
Mm-hmm.
See, its twos are all joined together, right? So
but how many, I mean, how many carbons are there?
18.
18 times two, then.
Yeah.
Right, that's our math.
It's two molecules thick, two lipid molecules thick.
Yeah.
So this is what I do with my students. We talk about what Newton is. Anybody know what a Newton is?
Yeah, by force.
Yeah.
Force.
Yeah. Maybe not. Getting a little bit better. No. So I found that things that weigh in Newton, and of course downward force, all this kind of stuff, gravity. So things that it's 101 grams, 0.224 pounds, so many ounces. That's a newton. So you could talk about, you know, milliburgers per meter if you wanted. Milliburgers per square meter, or margarine, or an apple, which is very kind of convenient. Not everybody knows that. So I show students this kind of thing, you know, newton and an apple. Anyway, so. Just the wine. So effects of cholesterol.
You must get great teaching about
it. Yeah, it's fun. Yeah, it's fun. So this was a simple thing that we did. We now took the phospholipids and added cholesterol. And as you increase the amount of cholesterol, that property goes up. And the thing I was mentioning a few days ago, red cell lipids, if you extract them from a population of red cells, just a bag of blood, and you recreate vesicles, they fall right on that line. So all the different lipids plus 40% cholesterol, they drop right on C18 with one double bond and one saturated chain. Now, you know, in my kind of retarded modeling, this is the only modeling I've ever done, is if we look at composites now, and you might think of this as being lipid cholesterol and lipid, because a lipid cholesterol tends to associate it, then we'll look at the fraction of lipid cholesterol versus the fraction of lipid. Does it behave like this? Of course, that's not the structure of this, not the structure, but we've got these very simple isostress and isostrain models, and if we actually just did that in a very kind of retarded way, here's the area of lipid divided by its modulus, 200, the area of cholesterol lipid divided by its modulus, 1200, that's the curve that fits between them. So, you know, if we look at other failure parameters, the tensile strength goes up, the critical strain reaches a maximum, goes down, and the energy also goes up. And in the paper that I had in the '90s, I said, well, this may be stability due to mixing, this may be, you know, like an entropic effect, and they said, we're not sure about that, throw it out, so I didn't read it in the paper. But you know, these are now, you know, the data associated with lipid cholesterol mixtures. And if we add all the systems we've ever looked at, this is the green ones I just showed you, and then as we go to more saturated phospholipids, of course they're not liquid at room temperature, but we add cholesterol and become liquid-like, we can get up to 40 millinewtons per meter and 4,000 millinewtons per meter for the area dilation modulus. So if we add cholesterol, that's the most effective way now to increase the stiffness of a lipid bilayer. And everybody's, you know, talks about cholesterol being this this rigidifier. Well, it actually keeps things liquid. The tensile strength limit is from around 42, and that's equivalent. If we divide it by the thickness of the bilayer, 4 nanometers, we end up with 10^7 newtons per square meter. And that's about the tensile strength of polyethylene or some of these organic CH2s. So all the bonding is in those CH2s now. It's not just the entropic hydrophobic effect of the chains. You've actually got some enthalpy associated with the material of the membrane. The modulus around 4,000. That's somewhere around 10^9, again, somewhere around the modulus of polyethylene. So for cholesterol-rich bilayers, the strength is mainly from van der Waals interaction. path from these largely all trans chains, and not just the hydrophobic effect that gets it together. Here's the hydrophobic effect down around, you know, 100 or so. And then all this extra stuff is bonded with the cholesterol. So we looked at...
question, yeah. The cholesterol.
Yeah.
You know, experimentally speaking, to manipulate many lipid enzymes in the, you know, or any other molecules in biological membrane, especially, you know, plasma membrane.
Yeah.
And it's a little dirty secret that I know that there. You add a little bit of cholesterol and all these, even the proteins become happy.
Become happy.
Big happy means that you get a little better, you know, for instance, enzymatic reaction or receptor works better.
All right.
This, you know, it's largely undocumented and the people give, you know, advice to other people. It's something of the matter of this increasing fluid of membranes that allow molecules to work better, or cholesterol itself, you know, does something to these proteins. Anybody know?
I haven't heard anything. This has been a dirty little secret, so I didn't hear it.
you know, I originally came from science skeletons and started to do more on the membrane.
Yeah.
Well, the beginning.
Well,
you
know, cancer cells have various levels of cholesterol, more or less, and that changes their behavior. It's, sure, we'll talk around. So here's making a pore. We have electrodes either side of this vesicle. I've played a couple of times. If you look here, the refractive index changes from inside to outside, and you just see this little pore form down at the bottom here. And so that's making a hole in a membrane. Of course, the mechanics of all this is that we've got a far field tension, we've got a line tension, and so we balance those, and we're just at a point where the pore could form and still remain open, and then it closes as the pressure goes down. So we would get line tensions now on the order of, you know, on the order of piconewtons.
Why isn't the vesicle rupture?
Huh?
Why isn't the vesicle rupture?
Because the far field tension is not big enough to open the hole. We've now controlled this tension. If we start with a very small tension and punch it with electric field, we get a hole and it recloses. If we do it again, you know, put the tension up, we don't reach the threshold for opening the hole until a certain tension, like I said, opens this hole, and it stays open for about half a second. And the tension in this membrane is just enough to balance that line tension, and that's when we measure the line tension.
Like a supercritical pore?
Yeah.
You're referring to the line tension of the pore that you
open? It's equivalent to a surface tension, it's a line tension. It's the hydrophobic energy associated with creating that line, that pore edge. But it was like a half micron hole. So this was a very kind of delicate experiment to get a to balance a line tension of a picomine. Anyway, I know you guys have got lots and lots of questions associated with this kind of stuff. You just go through it and we'll be online, and anytime you want to talk to me or Evan or Duncan or you.
Can you Skype?
Yeah, I can Skype. I've got lots of ways of being connected now. So these are some of the thermal transition properties. So we all know that we get, you know, liquid to solid. And so this is a single vesicle in a micropipette now, taking it through its phase transition. The transition temperatures are up here at 18, and the temperature in the bath. So that was it going through the transition, and then this is it remelting. And that little bumpy movement there is an iceberg going past the tip of the pipette, I think. Can't see it, but I would assume that what we're doing now is going up through essentially a mixed phase part of the phase diagram. And so if we took, this is a different material, but basically you've seen the thermal transition data, what we get is an area change versus temperature. So we saw the vesicle come down in area and then go through that transition and then end up cold, at solid, and then it remelts. So I don't know if you can see that again. So this is it going through the transition from liquid at 65 square angstroms down to 40. So this is the condensation, and then this would be the remelting, going back up this curve. So we start to see the area per molecule and the enthalpy associated with the transition now in these area, projected areas for the vesicle transition. Now, what we could then do with a frozen vesicle was hold it. This is I've sucked it into the pipette, I blew it out, turned it around, and now I'm about to suck it back in again. And there's positive shear here and negative shear and plug flow. And that's now a sheared membrane. And what we said in the paper in 1987 was yield shear and shear viscosity reflect density and mobility of crystal defects, grain boundaries in this two molecule thick membrane. And if we look at it as a function of temperature, this is a liquid transition temperature. This is one of the lower subphase transition temperatures. But this is where it's solid, and the yield shear and shear viscosity, now this is that kind of Bingham plastic idea, it gets, you know, stiffer and more viscous as you go down in temperature. So we were looking for these grains and grain boundaries. These are monolayers. This is one molecule thick now, the same kind of phospholipid on a gas bulb, because we're making ultrasound contrast agents. And if we have a fluorescent dye that doesn't stay in the bilayer but goes to the grains, then this is the image you get at 40 microns, and then this is an SEM of those same grains. So when this thing shears, the grains shear, just like in any crystalline material, but it's in 2D now. So what do they feel like? Well, we actually have an ability now to poke this thing. This is the gas bubble. That's what it feels like. This is an indentation test on a wax membrane. So if you blow up a plastic shopping bag and push it from Ralph's, that's what you get. You can see the structure there. So that's our indentation test, our hardness test, our softness test. So then we've looked at various permeabilities through the membrane, and this is water permeability. So we can start with a vesicle, we can transfer it to a hyperosmotic or hypoosmotic solution and get it to change volume, and do the volume change. Of course, it behaves like a perfect osmometer, going from 200 milliosmoles to 220, drops by 10%, and analyze that in terms of before and after infinite places, and you get the permeability coefficient. So we measure the permeability coefficient for bilayers as a function of composition. So now we're starting to do property-property correlations. If it's a stiff membrane and it requires a lot to expand it, how does it then stop water going through it? So these correlate. Water permeability against air per molecule. The air per molecule correlates obviously with the density, and that correlates with the elastic modulus. And so if you plot permeability coefficient against 1 over the modulus, the compliance, then you see very permeable membranes, and then membranes that contain sphingomyelin and cholesterol are down here at almost zero permeability and very, very stiff materials. On the order of plastics. So the stuff that surrounds those nerves that Hannah showed were sphingomyelin, cholesterol, myelin sheets, they're the Schwann cells, they've got a very high elastic modulus and extremely low permeability, and they act as insulators. So we also did a series of experiments where we looked at taking a vesicle and exposing it to avidin, to bind to biotin, tannic acid, which is a great way of tanning leather, it's in wine. We wanted to know how it interacted with the head groups. Also, micelles and monomers, how do they dissolve in bilayers or dissolve themselves bilayers? And then pH-sensitive peptides, where they became more hydrophobic, and then pH-sensitive polymers doing the same thing, and then the influence of a polymer on the surface. So I won't have time to talk about all this, but just one or two examples of avidin binding, tannic acid, micelles, pH-sensitive materials, and then barrier properties. So we had, this is an experiment where we blow now lysolipid from this pipette onto this vesicle. And so now a surfactant in this material is in this solution is entering that bilayer, mainly the outer monolayer, and then flipping to the inner monolayer eventually. And we can also then come in and blow the bathing solution and bring it back out. So the neat thing about this is that we can now measure the amount of lysolipid in the bilayer, not chemically, but just physically from the area change, because we know the area per molecules and the change in area. Then we get mole percent in the bilayer. This goes in and then comes out, and this was the basis for my invention of how to improve the permeability of bilayers at the phase transition, which is the other story. But for now, we're just looking at exchange between materials. So, you know, when you think about the bloodstream and all the surfactants and all the fats and everything, and one of the questions that came up the other day was, well, how do you know the drug is there when you've got a trillion red cells in the bloodstream which can do this? Well, they're all sinks for hydrophobic and hydrophilic materials. Everything's got a sink. And this is just, you know, one direct measurement. We looked at micelle fusion. I'll just skip past this. Tannic acid, Cid-Simon, this is a polyphenolic compound that's got lots of hydrogen bonding, and when you put it in vesicles, tiny little vesicles, 100 nanometer vesicles, they all aggregate. And so it causes lipid membranes to adhere at angstrom levels. Tom did the X-ray diffraction, and there's basically no water between these membranes now. They've been sucked dry, just like tannins do in leather. Well, you know, it does this, and now I got to tell you something about Cid-Simon. He's a funny guy, and he had a choice of hundreds of these electron micrographs to get published in the biophysical journal. And this was one, and that was the other. Now, you know, every time I do this talk, I'm stuck with whatever he published in the journal. Anyway, so whether you think that's funny or not, I don't know. So that's Cid-Simon, that's what I got to put up with. So, anyway, so it causes lipid membranes to fail, and here's a little cartoon, goes into the head group region and expands, so the outer monolayer, and that produces a compressive tension, an expanding tension in that half, and the bilayer eventually breaks. So here's a little experiment and a model now of how, you know, materials that could enter the bilayer would cause mechanical changes in its performance. We've looked at fusion of peptides. Here are some of these peptides at different pH. They kind of change conformation again. And there's a hydrophobic pocket, and this is the bilayer that sits in the interface here. And our measurements are, again, just measured relative area change as a function of pH. This is unstable, and then it becomes, this is stable above a certain pH and unstable below a pH. And there you start to see the influence of, say, viral peptides on membrane stability and how viruses can get into cells by disrupting the membrane. And then a whole series of inter-surface interactions. I'll just go through these relatively quickly again because they're all in the same kind of vein. But if we just look at the colloidal interactions, Evan said, you know, formation of specific or non-specific adhesive contacts induce stresses in the cells that eventually limit the extent of contact. They can only spread so much. So adhesion is not the only thing that you consider in adhering cells. It would also be the mechanical properties of the cells themselves. Subsequent separation, when you try and peel cells off or pull cells off in some way, then the physical force creates stresses that are transmitted through the cell cortex, the contact zone. Well, that contact zone now is made of proteins and plaques on either side of a lipid bilayer. The bilayer is not stressed anymore. It's the plaques. If you saw those desmosomes and the gap junctions, it's all protein. There's no stress on the lipid hardly. So implicit but significant, though less obvious, is the mechanical rigidity of cells, because cell stiffness directly opposes adhesion. And so here's our cell, and we've all seen this kind of thing. So, but that's a good example. So we looked at a whole range then of specific interactions. And the lipid bilayer provides this ability for us to look at some fundamental colloidal interactions now, this van der Waals interaction. So here's one vesicle, and it's spreading out another one of exactly the same composition. So if we control the tension here in the membrane with this suction pressure, then this point, this one point of this suction pressure, this isn't sticking to the pipette anymore, this is spread, take that contact angle and the pressure, and you end up with the work of adhesion. So we get van der Waals attraction involved in that, and we've looked at neutral bilayers, charged bilayers, neutral bilayers in polymer solution, grafted polymers in polymer solution, and then fusion. Now just quickly go through some of these, and maybe you want to look at them yourselves and see some of the kind of things that we've been doing. So these are the kind of attractions that are involved, if you want to just list them as potentials that oppose each other. And so again, one simple way of looking at this is, you know, if we add in negative charge, polymer in solution, grafted polymers to surface, and additional lipids. So that's our system with oil, two semi-infinite slabs of oil, non-infinite, but semi-infinite slabs across a water gap of 25 angstroms, 40 angstroms. And if we take this combination of these potentials, then that's the hydration potential. This drops off as one angstrom, two angstroms, and then this is the semi-infinite slab van der Waals. And so that's the van der Waals attraction. And if we change the head group hydration, go from PCs, fossil choline, mix in some fossil ethanolamine, then we can get less hydration. So this is kind of what I was talking about, that the hydration layers do act in a way now of coming in as a very steep repulsive potential, which really doesn't make much contribution to the total energy, but it places where that energy is actually positioned. And it's on the order of angstroms here, 20 to 10 angstroms.
How do you get this resolution at X-ray?
From X-ray diffraction. From X-ray diffraction between the bilayers. And this is a model, you know, this is just putting in this equation and just plotted these out, given this decay constant. So just saying these are the models, then let me just show the data. If we take the adhesion energy now that I measured from that experiment, they fall on this line. So what we're doing is we're still, you know, 12, 11 angstroms out from the between the bilayers. We're not in atomic contact where that can, you know, dive as 1 over d-cubed. We're just staying in this kind of 20 angstrom range. So it does follow the van der Waals, and the repulsive potential now is, you know, making very little contribution to the total energy, but it places where that energy is actually acting. This is the same thing that acts at the surface of proteins. Any water hydration has still got to be displaced with these kind of energies. This is in herbs which we're sensitive. If we add electrostatics now, put negative charges on here, of course we pull ions in, we get this Gouy-Chapman kind of idea, and osmotic pressures, and if we add that, so we've now added the electrostatics is out here, the hydration is in here, they're both exponentials, and this has got a decay constant now in 100 millimolar salt solution of about 9 angstroms. So that's a 9 angstrom exponential decay, this is a 1 to 2 angstrom decay, this is the van der Waals, and so, you know, how does this all play out? The electrostatics, vesicles become non-adherent when this van der Waals minus the electrostatics is about KT. And that's something that we brought up, I think, the other day, that Helfrich had these fluctuating membranes. And if we pull those, if we just push them together a little bit, then that those undulations don't contribute much. But it's this the undulations that keep them apart until the van der Waals can build up beyond that. If we add charge, so this is the zero charge, this is the van der Waals attraction now. We'll just look at this one thing. This is a sugar lipid. But so we've got the van der Waals attraction operating, the hydration potential is well inside that, the electrostatics is now at a 9 angstrom decay. You come down to 5% charged lipids and the things don't adhere anymore. So that fits again, just one of these predictions of Gouy-Chapman theory, down at this angstrom, 20 angstrom level of separation. If we add polymer then and no charge, then Evan was looking at red cells with Don Brooks about how PEG will aggregate red blood cells. And what we came up with, the story at the time was that polymer bridged the gap between cells. And I went to Evan and I said, why does dextran stick to lipid membranes? He went, I don't know, you're the chemist. And so I said, well, you know, maybe it doesn't. What about flocculation depletion ideas? And he came up with this and developed this model now of the polymer concentration in the gap is an osmotic pressure. The entropy of the polymer now is cranked up here or opposed, so for it to gain its entropy back, it goes back out. And we sum all the stresses from infinity to contact as a normal stress and get the work of adhesion, and that's his theory against my data for polyethylene oxide and dextrans. So we're starting to see now the van der Waals attraction is now, you know, increased, the energy of interaction is increased by orders of magnitude when you put polymers actually in the same solution as vesicles, and they all tend to aggregate. If we add now a charge to this, then we end up with membranes that are adherent, even though they've got charge, or they're adherent without charge. If we add charge, we find that in polymers of a certain size, we can still get adhesion when there's 30% negative charge on these surfaces. So this polymer now is very powerful in a depletion flocculation way of creating attraction in these systems. Now you might want to use this to aggregate cells and get receptors together that wouldn't normally get together.
This is
just a few gram percent. It's not a very viscous solution. This is polyethylene oxide. Of course, if you go high enough, you can get membranes that fuse. And that would be in the 20, 30, 40 gram percent range. So grafted polymer causes repulsion. We've seen that. We don't measure that in our measures because they don't even adhere. But if you look at what Tom has found, then these interaction distances now are just like the random coil, N3/5 for the polymer. If you put an additional polymer here, only when they start to mix do we get attraction. And basically what these polymers now do is act like a new surface. And so as long as this polymer is not in that surface, its concentration won't be high enough to cause the repulsion to be opposed. So there's thresholds for polymer concentrations. So we've been through this whole list of things. The steric grafted barrier now, if we look at Tom's data, you see this on the edge of bilayers. And you can start to plot now distance between bilayers as a function of the polymer and apply certain osmotic pressures that these things oppose. And of course, if you increase the molecular weight, then the distance between bilayers goes up.
Can you come up with some the principle between maybe this work where you have free membranes and all the work that's been done, where people also have looked at bilayers and polymer grafting onto solid surfaces and do the same measurements using what's the surface force apparatus. But is there anything characteristically different between these two classes of membranes?
No, except that we've got symmetric membranes.
It's
the same. Now they measure forces in all our stuff. We've had these discussions with Jacob. Evan has done lots of discussion with Jacob about how to compare forces versus energies and what we've done versus what they've done. But this is just a way of evaluating the structure of these interfaces that are on these few angstrom levels and the behaviors of polymers. Tom can now take a bare membrane with this one angstrom decay, and then we can see as we add more and more polymer of 10 mole percent, 5 mole percent of the polymer of increasing molecular weight, that steps it out. If you take the same polymer at different concentrations, that steps out the pressure of interaction. So, we end up with this kind of regime curve of mushrooms to brushes on a surface, and the liposome people used about 4 or 5 mole percent PEG 2000 to actually stop proteins binding to liposomes, keep them in circulation, and do their cancer treatment. So it originates in these kind of phenomena. So here's membrane fusion. Can we get membranes to fuse? And these were some of the first experiments we ever did that where we didn't want fusion, wanted to measure adhesion. But there's phosphatidylphenolamine involved. So if you've not seen membrane fusion, then those two membranes fusing. Here's one where the vesicle comes out, sits on it, and then spontaneously fuses. And then here's one where I put some stress on the membrane with the vesicle attached. Now in all these cases, I think we've got high PE, i.e. low membrane hydration, to get these kind of things, and there's probably a defect already formed because of a tether. And I'll finish up in a couple of minutes and then we kind of run over. Here's materials processing, liquids dried on surfaces, you hydrate them, and they form these kind of vesicles spontaneously. If we take a dried lipid film under a microscope and then add water to it or sugar solutions, non-electrolytes, we get nice vesicles here. If we add salt solution, just like I showed in the adhesion experiments, they don't even form. They don't, the layers don't separate because of this fangals. And then different ways of making membranes, the vesicles. And then Dennis Hayden, I had a postdoc with Dennis, who again died of leukemia several years ago, but he invented this black lipid film. He saw a talk by one of Overbeek's people from Holland in the 60s and thought, I wonder whether I could make a soap film underwater. And he made it from phospholipids. And so did Mueller. In the US, he heard the same talk several months earlier or later. So forward engineering, last slide. Systems, problem to be solved is prostate cancer. And you want to inject a drug in some kind of capsule, and the capsule that I invented actually releases drug in the bloodstream when it's heated to 41, 42 degrees with hypothermic heating. The vascular system looks like this when you start, and a few hours later all the vessels are gone and then all the tumors disappear. And so, you know, what I'd like to do is build a forward engineering premise for this by looking at reverse engineering membranes and cells next week, but look at things like solubility, diffusion, convection, the material design, processing performance. Lots of people involved, I guess, in our labs in Vancouver, Evan, and various people funding from some